tracks from their latest album, C'est la vie, a bilingual blend of original jazz songs and timeless standards. The Hot Sardines, Friday, October 4th at Kingston Grand Theater. Tickets for The Hot Sardines and the rest of the Grand Onstage season are on sale now at kingstongrand.ca.
This is Democracy Now!
We want to play with our friends, go to school, eat and drink, but this vaccination is of no use. It's only useful against polio, but the war has destroyed us. It has destroyed our houses. I wish I can play with my friends, go to school. I wish to eat and drink, like I used to before.
Amidst Israel's continued military bombardment of Gaza, we get an update on the polio vaccination drive with the president of Save the Children U.S., which has staff at a key vaccination site in central Gaza. And as tens of thousands of Israelis protest for a fourth day demanding Prime Minister Netanyahu agree to a Gaza ceasefire and hostage deal, we'll speak with Gershon Baskin, a longtime Israeli back-channel negotiator with Hamas, whose memoir is titled In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. And we go to Nashville, Tennessee, where the mayor's just introduced new measures to address what some call the city's Nazi problem. He reopened an investigation into unsolved bombings following the publication of the book Dynamite Nashville, Unmasking the FBI, the KKK, and the bombers beyond their control. We'll speak with the author, Betsy Phillips.
Members of this network were even present in Birmingham in the week before the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. So, you know, the implications of not catching them while they're in Nashville were enormous for the nation.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Palestinian Ministry of Health says Israel's latest attacks on Gaza have killed 42 Palestinians while wounding more than 100 others in the last 24 hours. In central Gaza, 9 people were killed as Israel bombed a residential building near a city park. 2 children were among the dead. Elsewhere, at least 7 Palestinians were killed Tuesday when Israel bombed the Ma'a College northwest of Gaza City, where hundreds of displaced Palestinians had taken shelter. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says its mass vaccination campaign against polio has so far reached about a quarter of Gaza's children after Israel agreed to 8-hour pauses in its attacks. This is Ghada Judah, a displaced Gaza resident and volunteer on the vaccination campaign.
We are displaced from Deir al-Bala. I gave my children the polio vaccine to protect them from disease, but I can't protect them from strikes and from death unless you help us, just as you helped us and delivered the medications to us to protect our children. So please stand with us to stop the war so that our children can live peacefully and to continue their studies.
Israeli forces have expanded their military offensive in the occupied West Bank, where troops have raided the Jalazon refugee camp north of Ramallah. Separately, Israeli forces surrounded Hebron for a fourth day, with more raids reported around Qalqilya, Nablus, and Bethlehem. The Palestinian Authority reports Israeli assaults on the West Bank over the past week have killed at least 33 Palestinians, including 7 children. Meanwhile, pressure is mounting for Israel to release Dr. Khaled Alsar, a highly respected Palestinian surgeon who was abducted by Israeli forces during a raid on Gaza's Nasser Hospital in March. Colleagues say Dr. Alsar has been tortured in Israeli custody at Ofer prison and at the notorious Sde Teiman prison camp in the Negev Desert, where several Israeli soldiers have been accused of raping Palestinian prisoners. Dr. Alsar is the lead author of a journal article just published in the British medical journal The Lancet. Democracy Now! Spoke to one of the paper's co-authors, Dr. Simon Fitzgerald, a Brooklyn trauma surgeon.
Our lead author, Dr. Khaled Alsar, remains forcibly disappeared. And it was only about probably the same week that the piece was published that we got word through Israeli Physicians for Human Rights, who were able to get a lawyer into Ofer prison, where Dr. Khaled Alsar is, at least at the time he was interviewed in July, was being held, and were able to get testimony that he indeed was abducted by Israeli forces, abused, maltreated, basically tortured.
Human Rights Watch reports doctors, nurses, and paramedics held by Israel have faced widespread torture, including beatings, rape, and sexual abuse, forced stress positions, prolonged cuffing, blindfolding, and denial of medical care. To see our segment on that report, go to democracynow.org. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets of major cities across Israel for the fourth day in a row to demand Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agree to a ceasefire and hostage deal. This morning, families of hostages held by Hamas held a protest outside Likud party headquarters in Tel Aviv. That follows Tuesday evening protests outside the Israeli army headquarters. We'll have the latest on Israel and Palestine. We'll speak with Israeli negotiator Gershon Baskin. In Ukraine, a pair of Russian missiles struck a military academy and hospital in the city of Poltava on Tuesday, killing at least 51 people and injuring more than 270 others. It was among the deadliest attacks on Ukraine since Russia's invasion in early 2022. In a separate assault, a 38-year-old mother was killed with her 8-year-old son in a Russian strike on a hotel in Ukraine's Zaporizhia region. Survivors say the assault came almost without warning.
There was an explosion 2 minutes after the air alert was declared. We had no time to hide. There was a very powerful explosion. We heard people screaming. We understood that there was a collapse at the hotel.
Overnight, Poland's military said it scrambled Polish and Allied fighter planes to its border with Ukraine after Russia launched drone and missile attacks on the western Ukrainian city of Lviv. Those attacks killed 7 people, including 3 children. Meanwhile, several of Ukraine's top government ministers have tendered their resignation as part of President Volodymyr Zelensky's biggest shakeup of his administration to date. Among the high-profile resignations are Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba and Weapons Chief Alexander Commission. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, at least 129 people were killed on Monday as they tried to escape the notorious Makala prison in Kinshasa. Dozens more were injured. The DRC's security minister says 24 prisoners were shot dead by guards. The rest reportedly died in a crowd crush set off by the chaos. The prison was built to house 1,500 people. At its peak this summer, it held 15,000. Amnesty International's described conditions at Makala prison as appalling, while prisoners report widespread hunger, overcrowding, and abuse.
I have been detained here for a year without trial. The conditions are difficult. The prisoners die every day. The people suffer here like you have no idea. The prisoners eat very badly, and the rations of the prisoners are often diverted by the prison officials.
In Nigeria, at least 81 people were killed Sunday when fighters from the Boko Haram militant group opened fire on villagers in the northeastern state of Yobe. Many survivors said the massacre was retaliation for the community's refusal to pay extortion money to Boko Haram fighters. 15 years of insurgency by Boko Haram has killed tens of thousands of Nigerians while displacing more than 2 million people. At least 12 migrants, including a pregnant woman and several children, have died after their boat capsized as they attempted to cross the English Channel. Some 65 survivors were rescued Tuesday. Most of the migrants on the boat are from Eritrea. The English Channel has become a common route for thousands of migrants attempting to reach the UK for safety. Here in the United States, the summer heat wave is bringing some of the year's hottest temperatures to southwestern states. Excessive heat warnings are in effect in Southern California, where the National Weather Service is forecasting several days of triple-digit heat with highs of up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit in some areas. Meanwhile, Phoenix, Arizona, Tuesday shattered its previous record after logging its 100th consecutive day of temperatures reaching 100 degrees or more, with no end to scorching temperatures in sight. Donald Trump entered a not guilty plea Tuesday after special counsel Jack Smith filed a revised criminal indictment against Trump for his efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Trump also waived the right to be present at his arraignment. Elsewhere, a federal judge in Manhattan has denied a request by Donald Trump to transfer his New York State criminal case to federal courts after rejecting Trump's claims that Judge Juan Merchan was biased against him. In May, Trump was found guilty of all 34 felony charges of attempting to influence the 2016 presidential election by falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments. He's still scheduled to be sentenced on September 18th. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's campaign has been ordered to stop using the music of the late singer Isaac Hayes at Trump rallies. A judge in Georgia agreed with a lawsuit brought by Hayes' family, who says the legendary singer would not have approved of Trump's use of his song, Hold On, I'm Coming. Montana Republican U.S. Senate candidate Tim Sheehy has been caught on tape making racist comments about Native Americans. Sheehy's remarks were first reported by the Charcoosta News, the official publication of the Flathead Indian Reservation, which obtained audio clips of Sheehy at campaign events last November.
Great way to bond with all the Indians to be out there while they're drunk at 8 a.m.
In more racist comments, Sheehy joked that members of the Crow tribe would, quote, let you know whether they like you or not. There's Coors Light cans flying by your head, unquote. Montana's home to 8 federally recognized tribes with more than 70,000 Native Americans of voting age. Political action committees have spent more than $44 million on Montana's Senate race, where Republicans hope to unseat Democratic Senator John Tester in November. Here in New York, federal prosecutors have indicted a former aide to Governors Kathy Hochul and Andrew Cuomo on charges she acted as an agent for the Chinese government. The U.S. Attorney's Office alleges Linda Sun, former deputy chief of staff to Governor Hochul, worked as an undisclosed agent of the Chinese government while her husband helped launder millions of dollars in kickbacks for personal gain. The 10-count criminal indictment also alleges Sun thwarted efforts by Taiwanese officials to speak to New York's governor and eliminated references to Taiwan and China's persecution of Uyghur Muslims from state communications. Hochul's office says the governor fired Sun in March of last year after discovering evidence of misconduct. And in Florida, the federal trial against 3 members of a Pan-Africanist group accused of conspiring with the Russian government to sow discord and interfere in U.S. elections began in Tampa this week. Amalia Shetela, longtime chair of the African People's Socialist Party, also known as the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, along with Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, were indicted last year for allegedly working on behalf of Russia in a multi-year foreign malign influence campaign in the United States. Another U.S. citizen and 3 Russian nationals are also part of the case. As the trial got underway Tuesday, Democracy Now! Spoke to Mwezi Odom, chair of Hands Off Uhuru.
The government, as we say, has nothing. And everything that they are accusing the Uhuru 3 of is pure political speech. And, you know, this is, again, just an attempt to rewrite history, you know, that includes, you know, decades of organizing and struggling for, you know, democratic rights in this country, such as the right to vote, the right to freedom of speech, the right to freedom of the press, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, you know, everything.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Amidst Israel's continued military attacks on Gaza, the World Health Organization says its mass vaccination campaign against polio has so far reached about a quarter of Gaza's children to protect them from paralysis after Israel agreed to 8-hour pauses in its attacks in certain areas of Gaza. This comes after health officials recently confirmed Gaza's first polio case in a quarter of a century, a 10-month-old child. This is Gaza resident Baha Al-Arbid.
We've heard about the truce for polio vaccinations, but I want to stay in this area because I don't trust this truce that has just begun. We still fear bombing will happen at any moment, as it happened this morning.
And this is Qada Judah, who recently got her vaccination, her children vaccinated at Yafa Hospital in Deir al-Bala, where she's also volunteering with the polio vaccination campaign.
We are displaced from Deir al-Bala. I gave my children the polio vaccine to protect them from disease, but I can't protect them from strikes and from death unless you help us, just as you helped us and delivered the medications to us to protect our children. So please stand with us to stop the war so that our children can live peacefully and to continue their studies.
This comes as residents of Gaza are also facing other diseases and chronic lack of food or access to education. This is Karim Yassin, a 10-year-old Palestinian boy in Deir al-Bala as well.
We want to play with our friends, go to school, eat and drink, but this vaccination is of no use. It's only useful against polio. But the war has destroyed us. It has destroyed our houses. I wish I can play with my friends, go to school. I wish to eat and drink like I used to before.
Just before we went to air today, Democracy Now! Received this update from Tarneem Hamad in central Gaza, who's part of the polio vaccination campaign with medical aid for Palestinians.
We would need at least 95% vaccination coverage during each round of the campaign to prevent the spread of polio and reduce the risk of its reemergence. However, we've been facing many challenges, given the severely disrupted health system, also water system and sanitation systems. Other requirements for a successful campaign delivery include sufficient cash, fuel, and functional telecommunication networks to reach communities with information about the campaign, which has been very difficult for all of our healthcare workers and social mobilizers who are working on the ground. Gaza has been polio-free for the last 25 years, so the reemergence, which the humanitarian community has warned about for the last 10 months, is another threat to the children in Gaza and also to the neighboring countries. A ceasefire is the only way to ensure public health security in Gaza and also in the region.
For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Yanti Sarepto, President and CEO of Save the Children U.S. Its staff is working from Deir al-Balah Primary Health Care Center, a key vaccination site, working there in Gaza. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Yanti. Can you explain what is happening, how many people you understand have gotten this vaccine, it's children that they're attempting to do?
Thanks, Amy. Yes, our site, our primary healthcare center in Deir al-Balah, is one of the 51 sites where vaccinations are given to children. I've understood that on day one, we were able to vaccinate 1,825 children already, which is encouraging, of course, and our staff are working around the clock to make sure that people understand, that parents understand where they can go to get vaccinations, that those vaccinations are safe, to make sure that children are prepped, and to make sure that healthcare workers are trained in order to do so safely. But of course, we need much more than just a couple of days to be able to give these vaccinations. Also, you heard the cover rate there between 90 and 95%. But you have to give two doses of these vaccinations, and they have to be 4 weeks apart. So one dose is not enough.
And can you talk about how these vaccines are being administered? Israel's agreed to certain pauses in the bombing. We're reporting about children being vaccinated in this area and children being killed in this area by Israeli bombs. Explain how it all happens and how the vaccines are getting into Gaza right now.
So the vaccines are getting in through the WHO over the road, but I think, look, you laid out so clearly. You can say I have an 8-hour pause in the window in which you can vaccinate these children in these 51 designated sites. But then, I mean, in practice, yeah, children then have to be moved to a particular site. Then sometimes they have to move back to where they were displaced, because most of the people in Gaza are displaced anyway. They're not in their homes. Homes are destroyed. So it's very hard to see. I can imagine, you heard the previous person in Gaza talking how worried they were to actually even travel across roads that are destroyed to some of these clinics. So there's real practical operational problems with this current pause. It is not a ceasefire at all. It is an 8-hour pause every day. And then again, the vaccine are oral drops, two or three drops per dose. You have to give them twice with 4 weeks in between. That means you have to track and trace these children as well. They're all displaced. Whatever happens between the intervening 4 weeks between those doses then also impacts how effective your campaign can be.
So according to the World Health Organization, the Israeli military bombardment of Gaza has damaged or destroyed 31 of 36 hospitals in the area. Can you talk about the significance of this and also how polio has reemerged after a quarter of a century in Gaza?
Yeah, it is unbelievable. Look, I was there end of March and I thought it was unbelievably dire then. And clearly it has gotten much, much worse since. Because I was there when people were still congregating in Rafah. And since then, they've been displaced from Rafah in the south of Gaza as well. So, you know, there is very, very limited access to healthcare. We set up that primary healthcare center in Deir al-Balah. If you look at the people who come there every day, over half of them have to walk more than an hour, to get even to that site. So that tells you something about the lack of healthcare, adequate healthcare in Gaza right now. And the emergence of polio doesn't surprise us. Save the Children and many other organizations and doctors have been warning against this for many, many weeks now. If you look at the sanitation, the sanitary conditions there, solid waste is everywhere in the Gaza Strip. There are not enough toilets, there are no showers. This was a situation just waiting to happen.
So you talked about how this is a two-dose regimen, and they're trying to get, just under 700,000 children to inject them with these vaccines. This never was an issue in the past. But if they are only able to get the first dose, is it ineffective?
That's not the right level of coverage. I think, and we should also remind ourselves, these are oral drops. Children are already in Gaza, are already malnourished. They're weakened. Their immune systems are compromised after almost a year of conflict, displacements, lack of food. You heard it here before, lack of clean water, etc. So to get adequate protection, they would definitely need those two doses. So we're concerned that even in the current setup, we will do what we can. The WHO is doing what they can, but it's going to be difficult to reach the coverage numbers in the way that you would normally do it in a campaign.
So surviving families in Gaza have to trust that as the polio vaccination campaign makes its way, for example, to Rafah, and then there's a pause there, that they won't be bombed if they leave their house or wherever they are currently displaced to get this vaccination. That's in Gaza. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Israelis are continuing their protests, calling for a ceasefire and a hostage deal from the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has said no so far. The significance of this and the position of Save the Children on a ceasefire.
We've been calling for a ceasefire since October last year because we know, as humanitarian operators, that that is the only way to get adequate aid, supplies, and services to children and families that need it now. In the current scenario, our amazing staff and volunteers in Gaza are doing what they can at the risk of their own lives. We've lost colleagues and partners over these past months. But it's really difficult to get people to come out, whether they get vaccinated, whether to get food, whether to get some level of mental health support or protection. When bombs are falling and deconfliction, so the safety of your convoys, of sending your own staff on the road with supplies to reach people, is not guaranteed at all.
In a moment, we're going to speak with Gershon Baskin, Middle East Director of the State International Communities Organization, a back-channel negotiator with Hamas in the past. So I wanted to switch gears just for 1 minute, Yanti, to talk about what's happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In mid-August, the World Health Organization declared a public health emergency in response to Mpox. This is Nzigiri Lakangira, whose child has been suffering from Mpox for days in an isolation ward in Kavumu in the eastern DRC.
Since my child got this disease and I brought him here, he only received one injection and some pills. The conditions here are very poor. We have no food and people are forbidden to visit us because we have a dangerous disease. We are suffering a lot and feel like we will die of hunger here.
Before we go, Yanti Sarepto, as chair and as president and CEO of Save the Children U.S., you were just in the DRC. Can you talk about this outbreak of Mpox and what people should understand and how difficult it is to get a vaccination right now?
Right, thanks. Yes, I was there in May. I was actually in South Kivu, which is now the epicenter, I think, of this particular outbreak with 50% of the cases. It is an incredibly contagious disease. It is very dangerous for children. So of the cases, I think 2/3 of the cases affect young children. And again, and we see a pattern here, Amy, whether it's Gaza or the DRC or Sudan for that matter. You know, contagious diseases, whether it's cholera or polio or mpox, you know, wreak havoc on populations that are already vulnerable, that are displaced, and there is no access to proper healthcare, vaccinations, no sanitation. So, and these diseases often cause even more casualties than bombs and bullets. So we're doing what we can. Again, we're working with communities to make sure that they understand how to prevent or reduce the risk of spreading. Simple hygiene, hand washing. Again, clean water is in short supply. People are weakened because there was already a food insecurity crisis. We're trying to ascertain where people can have access to healthcare. But as you heard on the previous segment, it is difficult to get access to medicine. And there are no vaccines in the DRC either.
Yanti Sarepta, we want to thank you for being with us, President and CEO of Save the Children U.S. Next up, as tens of thousands of Israelis protest for Prime Minister Netanyahu to agree to a Gaza ceasefire, we'll speak with Gershon Baskin, longtime Israeli back-channel negotiator with Hamas, his new book, In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. Stay with us.
يوم عم بنزيد شوف ايدي الكترة والحرية مش بالايد من يوم موعيته وانا بنت هاي البلاد بكاء اطفال وبسمة اولاد الارض صوبها اسود خيم علينا حداد بطلنا نعد احياء صرنا نعد اموات وانا بقول بكفي عاد بدي امسك قدري بكفي بكفي
by Mesa Daw. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tens of thousands of Israelis have protested across Israel for the fourth day in a row to demand Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agree to a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal. Today, families of Israeli hostages protested outside the Likud party headquarters in Tel Aviv. This followed a Tuesday evening protest outside the Israeli army headquarters. Despite the mounting pressure, Netanyahu remains defiant, refusing to accept a ceasefire deal while putting forward new demands and insisting he would not agree to any deal with Hamas unless Israel maintains control of the Philadelphia corridor along Gaza's border with Egypt. President Biden's called on the Israeli leader to do more to secure an agreement with Hamas following the recovery of the bodies of 6 dead hostages. On Tuesday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Matt Miller addressed the ceasefire negotiations.
Over the coming days, the United States will continue to engage with our partners in the region to push for a final agreement. During talks last week, we made progress on dealing with the obstacles that remain, but ultimately, finalizing an agreement will require both sides to show flexibility. It will require that both sides look for reasons to get to yes, rather than reasons to say no.
This comes as the Middle East Eye is reporting an anonymous Turkish foreign ministry official is accusing the United States of misleading the public by claiming that the Gaza ceasefire negotiations are progressing favorably and that Washington is not exerting enough pressure on Israel. We go now to Jerusalem, where we're joined by Gershon Baskin, Middle East director of International Communities Organization, a human rights advocacy group for years. He's been a back-channel Israeli negotiator with Hamas and ceasefire deals, including missing during Israel's current war on Gaza in 2011, when he helped negotiate the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit from Hamas captivity in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. On Tuesday, Baskin shared a deal Hamas leaders told him they would accept and that would lead to the release of all remaining Israeli hostages. He recently wrote, quote, "Let it be clear that Netanyahu has sentenced the hostages to death. Netanyahu stated that Israel will not leave the Philadelphia corridor, meaning that Israel will occupy Gaza for many more years. Netanyahu is sacrificing the hostages on an altar of his own personal political survival." Gershom Baskin, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out the situation as you understand it at this point and talk about the protests in the streets, what they're demanding of Netanyahu, and why he's refusing?
I think it's important to point out that, Amy, it isn't tens of thousands of Israelis who've gone out to the street. It's hundreds of thousands. To make that equivalent in the United States, it would be like 25 million Americans taking to the streets. That's the dimension of the protests that we've seen in the last days since the bodies of those six hostages were recovered. We could get many more Israelis on the street if they believed that the Hamas was really willing to release all the hostages, which is why I've pleaded with Hamas to say yes, not only to me, but to tell the Egyptians and the Qataris that they agree to the deal that I proposed to them, which is a three-week end of war, full-term ceasefire, Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, release of all the Israeli hostages, and a release of an agreed number and list of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. This is a deal that can be made. It is a million times better than the deal that the United States, Qatar, and Egypt have been trying to negotiate unsuccessfully for the last 3 months, which would just keep the war going and only release 32 hostages in 42 days. That's a bad deal. We need to have a good deal put on the table. I've communicated this to the White House, to the Qataris, to the Egyptians, and of course to the Israeli government. Now the officials need to push this through.
Why is Netanyahu refusing?
Well, it's very clear that Netanyahu doesn't want to end the war, as one of his top negotiators told me on Saturday. The problem with any agreement that we can put forward is that the bottom line is that Hamas won't make an agreement that doesn't end the war, and Netanyahu won't agree to any agreement that ends the war. He wants to keep this going. He certainly won't consider ending the war until they find and kill Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas leader in Gaza. But I think that the message of this past weekend was that there's no reason to believe that any hostage will survive if Israel, in fact, does find and kill Yahya Sinwar. There's no reason to believe that they won't simply execute all the remaining hostages.
Can you talk about the state of the negotiations since, it's widely believed that it was Israel who assassinated Ismail Haniyeh, the lead negotiator, on Inauguration Day of the new president in Iran. The significance of this?
I'm not sure that it had a real impact on the negotiations. Haniyeh was the face of the negotiators from Hamas with the Qatari prime minister, but he wasn't actually a member of the negotiating team. He wasn't in the room when negotiations were taking place. Of course, he was the leader of the Hamas Politburo and played a significant role there. There are debates of whether or not he was pushing for an agreement or pushing against an agreement. It doesn't really matter at this time. He's no longer there, and there are other leaders of Hamas right now. Hamas makes decisions generally in consultation, and they try to reach consensus. When there is consensus or when there is a decision, it's announced by the Hamas leader in Beirut, Osama Hamdan. And when Osama Hamdan says something in a press conference or on his Telegram page, it's official, and everyone in Hamas stands behind it. That's what we're waiting for now. That's what I'm waiting for now, to Hamas to say that we agree to a three-week deal that will end the war, will release the hostages and release Palestinian prisoners, of course, increase humanitarian aid into Gaza in a really substantial way. That has to be part of the agreement as well. But we really need Hamas to signal to the Israeli public that this kind of deal is on the table so that we can mass the public in the numbers way above a million people on the streets to force Netanyahu to accept it.
It keeps being said that he wants to keep Israeli soldiers in the Philadelphia corridor. I spoke to Gideon Levy yesterday on the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and he said it's not even worth talking about this. No one even knew what this was months ago. Suddenly it has become so key. What is your assessment of what Netanyahu wants there and why this has become important?
Look, last night on one of the main Israeli television stations, Alon Ben-David, a very significant military correspondent, said that in all the past months that the Israelis are searching for tunnels that lead underneath the Philadelphia corridor, the borderline, 14-kilometer borderline between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, they haven't found a single tunnel that penetrates the border. We have to recognize that this is an international border. There is a sovereign Egyptian side of the border. The Egyptians are responsible for sealing that border. And I'm certain that with the request from the United States and Israel, the Egyptians would agree to American finance and technology know-how and American supervision or observers on the ground to ensure that the border is closed. This is a made-up issue by Netanyahu to create a new, I don't know what we want to call it, a new excuse for Israel to remain in Gaza. Essentially, at the end of the day, what it means is that Israeli soldiers would be sitting ducks along the line of this border where insurgents from Hamas would be able to kill them. And that's what we're facing today. Hamas has been largely decimated in terms of its military power, but they have the ability to engage in armed insurgency and kill Israeli soldiers every single day. Hamas fighters popping out of a tunnel and shooting an RPG at an Israeli tank or an Israeli vehicle. And we should be reminded of 18 years of Israel sitting in southern Lebanon where soldiers came home every week dead as well. That should be a lesson for us.
Can you talk about what happened back when you were involved with the negotiation to release the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit for 1,000 Palestinian prisoners? And do you take any lessons from then to what's happening today?
It's a very different situation when we're talking about over 100 hostages in an active war that's being fought for 11 months with the total destruction of Gaza and 40 to 50,000 Palestinians killed and 1,700 Israelis killed or more than that so far. So it's really different. But there are some lessons. One is that there's no replacement to a direct secret back channel with direct communication between the parties. Even if it's not an official channel, it's a way to deliver messages and to brainstorm and find new ideas. There's no doubt that negotiating through third-party mediators like Qatar and the United States and Egypt convolutes the situation, makes it much more complex, and each side has its own interest here. There's great reluctance to make compromises. What I've seen, what I've observed over the last 18 years that I've been doing these negotiations is that sometimes it's just unbelievable the kind of behavior of the people in charge of these negotiations, who sometimes seem to be as if they're in a kindergarten classroom, with bringing up issues and ways of talking to each other or talking at each other that resemble what young children would do, rather than being responsible and finding direct ways to resolve the problem, which is ending the war and getting the hostages home. They never deal with it directly. And this is the truth today as it was many years ago when Gilad Shalit was in captivity.
What do you think it would take at this point in this last minute we have, Gershon?
I think it would take an Hamas acknowledgement that they're ready to release all the hostages so that we can mobilize the Israeli streets. And it will take extreme American pressure on Netanyahu to make a deal. And the Americans have the pressure if they were to choose to use it.
And what would that look like, the U.S. putting pressure on Israel?
Well, look, the most obvious are the two things that they are the most powerful. One is the shipment of arms to Israel, which is unlikely to happen. The other is the use of the veto in the Security Council and other international arena. But the American-Israel relationship is so deep and so wide that there are many ways that the United States can use soft power with Israel to get the message across. And what's important is that it's not done just to Prime Minister Netanyahu, but that the Israeli public knows what the United States of America wants and what it's demanding from Israel. Again, we are still a democracy, or what's left of a democracy, and the people are the sovereign, and we can mobilize the people if we have the tools to do that.
Biden, what is the single most important thing he can do as president of the United States?
to put a deal on the table, which is a good deal, the kind of deal I talked about, and to let the Israeli public know that it's there. The United States is backing it, Qatar is backing it, Egypt and Hamas will support it. That's the most important thing that Biden can do right now.
Gershom Vasquez, I want to thank you for being with us. Middle East Director of the International Communities Organization, longtime back channel negotiator with Hamas. His memoir is titled In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. When we come back, Dynamite Nashville. Back in 20 seconds. Sam and Dave, written by Isaac Hayes, a Georgia judge, has agreed with a lawsuit by the Hayes family that said the legendary singer would disapprove of Donald Trump's campaign's use of his song and ordered the campaign to stop playing it at rallies. The Trump campaign, that is. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Nashville, Tennessee, where the mayor recently introduced four new measures that attempt to protect free speech rights while also addressing what some call the city's Nazi problem. Nashville Mayor Freddie O'Connell also announced in July he's reopening a police investigation into three unsolved bombings in Nashville from the civil rights era. This all comes after Nashville journalist Betsy Phillips published a new book into the attacks titled Dynamite Nashville, Unmasking the FBI, the KKK, and the Bombers Beyond Their Control. In her book, Phillips writes, quote, just as Nashville was where civil rights icons like John Lewis, James Lawson, and Diane Nash began, Nashville's also where a network of racial terrorists began, unquote. Around the same time the book just came out, neo-Nazis marched through Nashville's downtown for the third time this year. Many carried U.S. and Confederate flags. A viral video shows them yelling racist slurs at a group of black children. After the attack, the children and their parents spoke out. This is 10-year-old Detonio Wilson and his mother sharing the advice she gave him.
I feel like it was racist because they were just saying bad words to us, and the police didn't do nothing. They were just telling us to go home.
Don't leave it stuck in the back of your minds like that, because it will mess you up tremendously, yes. Like for a long time. Yes.
For more on this, I spoke with Betsy Phillips about her new book, Dynamite Nashville, for which she spent nearly a decade trying to uncover the truth about the three civil rights era bombings in Nashville that all went unsolved. The Hattie Cotton School in 57, as it was set to integrate. The Nashville Jewish Community Center in 58. Which had held integrated activities, and the home of leading civil rights lawyer and city council member Z. Alexander Luby in 1960. I asked Phillips to follow a trajectory from this year's neo-Nazi marches in Nashville back to the unsolved bombings that are now the focus of a newly assigned cold case detective with the Nashville police.
Well, one of the reasons that I'm really excited about the mayor reopening these investigations is that the Nashville Police can do something now that Nashville Police in the 50s could not do, which is make a bunch of long distance calls. So one of the biggest impediments to solving these cases back in the day, and one that I, just because I have email, could easily overcome, is that I could contact Florida and see what records they had. I could easily email Birmingham and see what they had. And that's just not something that was really possible in the 1950s. So while everybody, throughout the South, they knew that there was this group, the Confederate Underground, because after they bombed something, they would call and take credit. So municipalities throughout the South wanted the FBI to step in because they're like, you have funding and you have the ability to do these kind of interstate investigations. And look, they're using the same name throughout the South for both these bombings of black institutions and bombings of Jewish institutions. So you figure out who they are and we'll stop them. And the FBI was repeatedly like, no, these are local matters. They're unconnected. They don't have anything to do with each other. And so they were just able to continue their activities. And, you know, members of this network were even present in Birmingham in the week before the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. So, you know, the implications of not catching them while they're in Nashville were enormous for the nation.
So let's get real specific. Of course, the Birmingham bombing was 1963 in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the Hattie Cotton School in 1957 that was set to integrate. What happened?
Yes, right. So John Casper, who was a racist activist, had been in town all month basically fomenting discord. And racists throughout the South, like Asa Carter, for instance, and Bill Hendricks from down in Florida, had come up to help him. The FBI heard from an informant, hey, these guys have dynamite, they're building a bomb. And then they heard again from the informant, my friend has seen the dynamite. The FBI did not share this with the Nashville police. So the day of school integration, protesters went to all the schools that they knew were integrating. No one knew ahead of time that Hattie Cotton was integrating because Patricia Watson's family didn't pre-register her. They just registered her the day of. So Hattie Cotton didn't have the same kinds of police presence that these other schools had. And that evening, when after the first day of school, when police were trying to figure out, you know, like, well, where do we need to be? What do we need to be keeping an eye on? They only went to the schools where there had been mild riots. I don't know how to better put that, demonstrations that day. And since there hadn't been big demonstrations at Hattie Cotton, they left it a sitting duck. So that night, at right about just after midnight, the school blew up. The whole East Wing was blown up. And then in the aftermath of that, one of the things that got me hooked on this, where I was like, oh, this is much more complicated than I realized, because in the FBI records, they talked about, like, we have these witnesses, we are not sharing them with the Nashville police. And then in the FBI file, there's a memo outlining, like, yes, we had this information, here's when we had it, blah, blah, blah. And someone had crossed through September 10th, the day of the bombing, and backdated it so that it looked like they had informed the Nashville police before the bombing that they knew that there was dynamite in town and this bombing plot. So that's when I was like, well, clearly this is a bigger story than just, like, you know, racist blow up a school. Like, they're, you know, why is the FBI behaving this way? Why is the Nashville police behaving this way? And then as I'm going through the FBI file, towards the end of the file, I find a report that the FBI is hearing from an informant who did the bombing. And I'm like, wait, so they had a name, or two names actually, by the beginning of 1958, and yet these bombings are still unsolved. And then when you fast forward to the JCC, or the Jewish Community Center, in Nashville itself, that bombing is not really thought of as being one of these civil rights bombings. Like, people know about Hattie Cotton and they know about the Luby bombing, but they haven't really been viewing the JCC as part of that, even though after the JCC blew up, the bombers called the AP, the Tennessean, the Rabbi Silverman from the temple, and said, we have just blown up your center of integration, and next we're going after the judge who approved Nashville school desegregation. So these bombers tried to make it as clear as possible that the JCC bombing was related to school integration, but somehow that's kind of fallen out of the collective knowledge. But when I found that out, and I found that they called themselves the Confederate Underground, not only did that lead me to a bunch of Confederate Underground bombings throughout the South, Charlotte, Gastonia, Jacksonville, Miami, Birmingham, Atlanta, so on. I also found that so the Confederate Underground said, you know, we've just blown up your center of integration, next is Judge Miller, and then we're going to blow up the temple in Belmete. In 1981, a group calling itself the Confederate Vigilantes tried to blow up the temple. So I went to talk to the head of the Confederate Vigilantes, Gladys Gurgenty, to ask her if the Confederate Vigilantes and the Confederate Underground were related. And apparently, weirdly enough, I was the first person to ever do that, even though she was extensively interviewed by the FBI and the police. So I spoke with the U.S. attorney who had prosecuted her. And again, this is just like a matter of technology and the difference, right? Because I was easily able to Google Gladys, and I was able to easily learn that she grew up here. But the U.S. attorney who tried her thought she was from Detroit because that's where she and her second husband had lived for most of their married life. So he had never even thought to connect her to the bombings here because, as far as he knew, she didn't live here. So, you know, that, again, like in many ways, there were difficult things, but it was much easier for me to investigate these crimes just because, like, I have Google. And police and the FBI back then didn't. And then the third bombing, of course, is the bombing of Z. Alexander Luby's home in April of 1960. This, to me, the other two bombings, I have a pretty good idea of who did them. This bombing was the most difficult to solve, and I don't think that I have it 100% solved. But it definitely had left like the least clues. And yet he was a sitting city councilman. So he was an active U.S. politician who someone tried to assassinate. You would think that this would be something that people would want solved just because they would want to know if they were also politicians, if Betsy, they were in danger.
Betsy, I want to play a clip of the civil rights activist John Lewis, who would later serve 17 terms as a Georgia Congress member, has said the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act were written, quote, with our blood. In a 1979 interview for the documentary They Loved You Madly, John Lewis spoke about that morning that you're describing right now, April 19th, 1960, and the bombing of the Nashville home of the civil rights lawyer, Z. Alexander Luby.
Oh, it was early one morning, about 6 o'clock. Z. Alexander Luby, who had been a strong supporter and defender of civil rights, a member of the city council, the first black member of the city council in the city of Nashville, he was a NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyer. He had been the legal counsel for all of the students that had participated in the city and that brought some of the original school desegregation cases and worked with Thurgood Marshall. We heard that his house had been bombed, and all across the city, on the different college campuses, we had a similar reaction to call a meeting of the Nashville Central Committee. The Central Committee was the executive committee of the Nashville Student Nonviolent Movement. By, I would say, between 6:30 and 7 o'clock, we were meeting. Shortly after 7, we had sent the mayor a telegram saying to the mayor that we would have a march on City Hall. The mayor was Ben West, was the mayor's name, to protest the bombing of Trenton Luby's house. By noon, we had more than 5,000 students from Tennessee State, Fisk University, American Baptist Theological Seminary, Meharry, and Vanderbilt, and people from the community with a sense of righteous indignation.
John Lewis later became a congress member representing Atlanta. When the march reached City Hall that day, Activists confronted the mayor about the violence and asked if he believed it was morally wrong for the lunch counters in Nashville to be segregated. The mayor agreed it was wrong, and negotiations led 6 downtown stores to begin serving Black customers at their lunch counters for the first time the following month. And John Lewis, this was his first, as you said, coming out of Nashville. He wasn't born in Nashville, but this was his first major action where the Nashville sit-ins of 1960. And in the middle of this, yet another, like your title, Dynamite Nashville, bombing of this attorney. So, Betsy, tell us about J.B. Stoner, a suspect in the Nashville bombings, perhaps best known as one of James Earl Ray's lawyers, James Earl Ray, the man who assassinated Dr. Martin Luther King. Talk about his connections.
Right. So J.B. Stoner was a Chattanoogan who rechartered the Klan when he was in high school. He was also pen pals with like an actual Nazi, which is one of the reasons I don't like to use the term neo-Nazi, because there's no break, right? These are just Nazis. Stoner, at the time I'm looking at, seems to have been operating as somewhat of a like terrorist consultant. So if you were a local Klan group that wanted to bomb a school or a church or whatever, rather than you having to go around practicing, you know, placing bombs or building bombs, which would have opened you up to potentially getting caught before you could hit your target, you could just call in Stoner and he would walk you through how to build a bomb. He had connections that would bring you in dynamite. If you didn't have somebody on your team who was willing to actually do the bombing, as long as you supplied a driver, he could supply a bomber. So I started looking, you know, just all of the places that he pops up. And at some point, and I think it is because of what he learned in Nashville helping with these bombings, he also then went to law school. So by the time you get into the 60s, what you see is that all the violence that J.B. Stoner is helping direct, if you got caught, then he could step in and represent you. So it was like a one-stop shop for evil.
And finally, I mean, it was in Tennessee, not in Nashville, but in Memphis, 8 years mm-hmm. later, when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, a target of the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover obviously despised him, targeted him. What kind of connections, you talked about Stoner representing the assassin, but what kind of connections did you see leading up to that you could identify in your city of Nashville?
Right. Well, one of the things that, so J.B. Stoner was actually one of the first region-wide, there had been like local people wanted to kill King who lived in the same towns as King, but J.B. Stoner and his friend Jack Brown, not to throw another name into the mix, but J.B. Stoner and Jack Brown were the first two like region-wide people who didn't have like a direct connection to King who had plots to kill King. Stoner's plot was in 1958, and then Jack Brown told a friend in 1960 that he had been traveling from Chattanooga to Atlanta to try to figure out if he shot King, how could he get out of that neighborhood alive? So to see Stoner's name continue to pop up in these circles, and then what I heard is that after King was killed in Memphis, that FBI informants were sitting in a room with Stoner, who was in Jackson, Mississippi at the time. And before the news had hit, the phone rang, Stoner picks it up, and he's like, oh good, he's a good one now, a good N-word now, and then hung up. And then they heard the news that King had been killed. But the FBI's contention has always been that J.B. Stoner wasn't involved because he wasn't in Memphis. But one of the things that I found in my research is that Stoner, like, early on, he was directly involved with bombings, but very quickly, he came the week before, he set things up, and then he left town. So the fact that Stoner wasn't in town for, you know, in Memphis for the assassination means nothing about whether or not he was involved. So that was, you know, very shocking to me to realize, like, again, like, if these folks had been dealt with when they were in Nashville before they were getting really good at committing violence and getting away with it, the 60s would have just looked a lot different.
Betsy Phillips, historian and author of the new book, Dynamite Nashville, Unmasking the FBI, the KKK, and the Bombers Beyond Their Control. Her book prompted Nashville's mayor to now reopen a police investigation into the three civil rights era bombings she focuses on. To see the full interview, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
On Saturday, September 7th, the Queens Gaels will host the York Lions at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Last year, Queens walked into York Stadium and left with a resounding, historic victory. But this is not the same program we saw 1 year ago. A new era is dawning at York University. A new coach, new players, and new culture has restored the roar. A team that once fought just to survive is once again playing with pride.